Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to your June 30th Committee on Rules. As you can tell, we have a number of bills in front of us today. We'd ask when folks come forward that you identify yourselves for the record and which bill you're here on. We are trying to get these bills to the Senate floor tomorrow, so we have staff persons listening to the testimony at this point in time. So if I'm going a little more slowly than normal, that's why, and I also want to make sure we got the information accurate. So what I'm going to do is open a public hearing on House Bills 21. Representative Nelson, are you testifying on all of them? Okay. House Bills 2136, 2681, 2862, 2878, HCR 9, HJM 13, HJM 15, HJM 16, HJM 18, HJM 25, and SJM 8. Representative Nelson, why don't you come on forward?
Thanks, James. Just, you know what? I think we'll just go through them all. Just like that. Good idea. Go ahead.
Chair Brown, Senator Atkinson, and Tiffany, and Linda, thank you so much for allowing us to be here today. I am here on behalf of each one of these bills that advocate in some measure for our veterans, our military, and their families. And I would just like to say this. What we were told by the good Darlene Hooley is that we do have a lot of work to do in Washington. So that's the reason that we have these, I believe there's five House joint memorials, and then we have the one Senate joint memorial. And these are critical. These are critical issues. I was going to say that here in the state, what we're attempting to do is to restore the credibility of our concern for our veterans. 146 years lacking full support for our veterans and our military. And we have worked so hard. Every one of these bills have just received detailed hearings. We had excellent support from all of the military, all the organizations that are support organizations, from the AMVETS to American Legion to the Paralyzed Veterans of America. All of them were there to give us advice, as well as many experienced officers in our military and family members. We took our mission very seriously, and each one of these bills, without having to go into every one of them, they all rectify a very serious deficit in our system, our American way of life. For example, not recognizing certain veterans, but recognizing others for high school diplomas. Not recognizing the atomic veterans when they were just totally forgotten. For many years, for example, but recognizing others. We have attempted to rectify all of these various situations. At the same time, what we've learned from World War II and certainly from Vietnam War is that we shouldn't wait 60 years to recognize what our veterans and our military have done for us and are doing for us. So basically, I'm here to say I'll accept questions on any of these, but I would tell you that I think you'll find, and to the best of my knowledge, we only ever had a hearing in the House that had two individuals who voted other than all of the bills were voted unanimously. And those two issues related to those two votes, I believe, related to issues that are not on this page today. So I would appreciate your support. And once again, thank you. And on behalf of the veterans and our military and our families, thank you for having the same desire by pushing these forward. I can't think of anything better for July the 4th.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. Any questions for Representative Nelson? Okay. Thank you very much. Appreciate you joining us today. Colonel Mike Caldwell, why don't you come on up? And David McDonald, you're here on 2862. Mr. McDonald? Okay. We're still in subcommittee. I'm going to open a hearing on House Bill 2862 for Mr. McDonald and Mr. Caldwell. And go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Colonel Mike Caldwell, Deputy Director of the Reagan Military Department. I've signed up on several of these, and I
yes.
will belabor all of them. You don't have to go through that laundry list. I will just tell you that 2862, just for hearing that one specifically right now, directs the higher education to do what they're already doing, in large part. I think it's probably not a bad bill, though, to get it codified in the law, so there isn't any question as to what the policy of the state is. It's a fairly common practice right now, and I have not heard of any difficulties. Perhaps there are, but I have not heard of them. For soldiers coming back, or any soldiers, sailors, airmen, seamen, who have had difficulty converting their education and their military schools into college credit. So having said that, I think the bill was worked very extensively in the House Committee, Veterans Committee, and it probably is a good state policy to let everybody know that's what the continuing policy will be.
Thank you. Mr. McDonald.
Thank you, Chair Brown, members of the committee. For the record, my name is David McDonald. I am Director of Enrollment Student Services for the Oregon University System. As the Colonel has indicated, this very much codifies actions that have been in place in the Oregon University System for a number of years. I want to take this opportunity to inform the members of the committee of several other things that we do in support of our members of the armed services who happen to be students. The handout we've given you is on the Voyager Tuition Remission Program, which is a financial aid program that we designed this year to assist members of the Guard and reservists who are returning from active duty since September 11, 2001. This is to assist them so that they can, again, regain the education tools that they need to further their careers and their activities in our society. Other activities we have on our campuses include active Veterans Affairs offices, which provide delivery and services to students, both current and inactive members of the military. And again, I would like to summarize quickly that we are committed to serving this group of soldiers back to our campuses. This particular House bill provides no problem to us, and we are very supportive of it.
All right. Any questions? Colonel Caldwell, why don't you stay here?
Ma'am.
Thank you very much. Anybody else wishing to testify in particular on House Bill 2862? Okay. I'm going to close that public hearing, open a public hearing on the remainder of the bills. Colonel Caldwell, did you want to testify on each of these bills? I have you signed up for a number of them.
Madam Chair, I don't think that's necessary. I would like to testify on House Bill 2136A, though, if we could.
Okay. All right. So let's move into House Bill 2136A. We now have a full, we have a quorum. And I'll note for the record that Colonel Caldwell is here on, HJM 13A, HJM 15, HJM 16, SJM 8, and HJM 25. Okay, for the record, on House Bill 2136, Colonel Caldwell.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Colonel Mike Caldwell, Deputy Director of the Oregon Military Department. House Bill 2136 Alpha corrects or actually updates our Oregon Code of Military Justice. This is how we govern militia, the Oregon militia. All members of the Oregon National Guard fall under this because they're under control of the governor while they're not called up in Title 10 federal duty. This piece of law has been changing myopically over the last decade, 15 years. What this bill does is bring it up to date with the Oregon or with the Uniform Code of Military Justice to further connect us with the federal government, who we deal with on a considerable part of in our role. It also, that's one major piece of it. The other two major pieces of it are, one, it allows the Adjutant General the authority to call a courts martial. Right now, that's only allowed to the governor, and this extends that to the governor or the Adjutant General. And we found that without that, in some instances, that could be difficult. It could be a difficult situation, circumstances for the governor. And we sought this change because we think it's necessary in order to make sure that happens. court-martial may or may not happen otherwise. The last thing it does, which is not a change, but it makes it more evident and not so, I guess, so oblique, is that it allows anybody who's confined under this part of the Oregon Revised Statute to go to a county jail at no cost to the National Guard. That's currently in the law, but it's not as defined. So we wanted to make sure that was clear. Wanted to make sure that was evident. And just tell you, in 35 years in this organization, I've never seen anybody arrested and put in a county jail. But it allows that capability. So those are the three major tenets of the legislation, and I want to make sure that those were clear to you, so when you vote on it, you know what we're trying to do here.
Thank you. Questions for Colonel Caldwell? Great, thank you.
And I would just say the others, I lend my support for their good legislation.
Thank you. All right, let's bring up Mr. O'Reilly and Mr. Sullivan on HGM 18A.
For the record, my name is Mike Sullivan. I am the Oregon lobbyist for the Association of Western Pulp and Paper Workers, also known as AWPPW. I'm here in support, obviously, of House Joint Memorial 18. Excuse me, do you want me to go first, Chair Brown?
However you want to do it.
Okay. I am a disabled veteran, but it's not a war injury. It's a medical problem. The continually short-funded of the VA is part of the problem that I have. The VA has never been fully funded. This bill, which I helped to amend, asks that the VA be funded directly under mandated funds, which has never been done. I don't know if you've ever seen the movie with James Cagney, but he comes back after World War One, and he beats up the guy who took his job because the doughboys that came back had no guarantee of the work when they came back. The veterans seem to be forgotten, and this is a window of opportunity because of the two wars we presently have. Nothing's been done for the veterans, and we need the federal government, when they initiate a war, or there is a war, to take care of those that go. The analogy I gave the Veteran Affairs Committee, which I must applaud, I think I went to every meeting that they had, the analogy I offered was that if Linfield, which won their championship, and a ball player ruined his knee, would say after the season, championship, we won, we got the trophy, you now take care of your leg. It's not right. It wouldn't work in McMinnville, and it shouldn't work for our federal government. So I urge everyone, this committee, anyone that's here, Kevin, myself, to contact anyone, particularly Darlene Hooley, who's done a great job to push this agenda. It's shameful. And I'll take any questions.
Thank you. Sure.
My name is Kevin O'Reilly, and I'm here today representing the Oregon Paralyzed Veterans of America. We are the state chapter of a national veteran service organization. House Joint Memorial 18A urges the U.S. Congress to take the funding for veterans health care from the yearly discretionary appropriation cycle and place it in the mandatory funding arena. Our organization, along with other veteran service organizations such as the Disabled American Veterans, the Veterans of Foreign Wars, and AMVETS, have for many years advocated for mandatory funding for veterans' health care. We believe mandatory funding is the best avenue for providing adequate funding for the Veterans Administration health care system. Lack of adequate funding has and is causing problems for veterans attempting to access health care. We have seen delays and deferrals for surgeries, insufficient staffing on hospital wards, which further delays veterans from receiving needed health care. We have seen delays in the hiring of skilled professionals, particularly in the mental health field. This is having a detrimental effect on veterans receiving assistance in a timely fashion. We, along with our sister chapter in Washington State, are pooling our resources to send physical and occupational therapists to continuing education seminars. We do this because the VA has recently cut the funding for these essential professionals to be able to keep abreast with new developments in their fields. We are seeking cuts in research dollars. We are seeing cuts in research dollars for prosthetics. This at a time when traumatic injuries are resulting in an increase in amputations. We see equipment such as X-ray machines that are over 20 years old and not being replaced. We have seen cuts to small things. The Portland VA Medical Center has a satellite facility in Vancouver, Washington. This facility contains a long-term care unit, a hospice unit, and a comprehensive rehabilitation unit. We are forming a partnership with other local veterans organizations to provide coffee for the veterans housed in these units. The funds for the coffee for these veterans was recently cut. Within the last few weeks, the Senate Committee on Veterans Affairs learned that the VA had a shortfall of approximately $1 billion for veterans' health care. You may have read about this in the paper.
Thank you. I actually, Mr. Riley, heard about it on NPR the other day.
Yes. It's been out there for a while. The VA had been robbing Peter to pay Paul, taking monies from other programs such as facility maintenance to use for veterans' health care. This means leaky roofs were not being repaired. Deferring maintenance now may have had a cumulative effect as high as $5 billion over the next few years. Yesterday, the 29th of June, the Senate approved emergency funding of $1.5 billion to cover the shortfalls. This despite the fact that for years veterans and service groups have been asking Congress to provide adequate funding. In the last few years, the VA has seen a surge in enrollment. 103,000 eligible veterans are from the recent conflicts. Approximately 60% of these from Guard and Reserve components. Yet this is a small portion of the total new enrollment. A far greater number are from previous years in tours of duty, World War II, Korea, Vietnam, and the times between. I understand the number of new enrollees is over 1 million. Some in the federal government have suggested that perhaps the funding needs of providing care for those wounded and maimed veterans from our current conflicts could be met by encouraging other veterans currently using the VA to seek health care elsewhere. They have suggested that some veterans could pay enrollment fees or increase in current copays on pharmaceuticals and for appointments, in essence charging one veteran to support the health care of another. Some in Washington believe that veterans' health care is a domestic social program. We respectfully disagree. Providing for our veterans is part of the cost a democratic nation incurs for having a military. It's part of the cost of having a war. We are excited and encouraged to see that a state's legislative body also asked that our veterans' health care system receive adequate funding, and to do so without asking the veteran to foot the cost. We applaud Oregon State Legislature in standing up for those who have so honorably served our nation, and on behalf of our veterans, we encourage your support for House Joint Memorial 18A. Thank you. If you have any questions I can possibly answer, I'll be more than happy to.
Thank you, Mr. O'Reilly.
Madam Chair.
Senator Ringo.
Do you make a distinction between the veterans' health care needs that arose because of combat or service in a combat operations as opposed to other health needs? Is there any distinction?
We make a distinction between service-connected and non-service-connected. An injury could happen during your time of service. That's counted. And then it might happen after you've been out of the service for a while. And we count on those two.
Okay.
And it depends on. There are eight categories of eligibility in the VA system.
I see. Just to follow up, Madam Chair, are the ones that are service connected, are those given a higher priority?
Yes.
Or more resources?
Okay. Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Solomon, did you wish to respond?
Yes, Chair. Senator Ringo, but Kevin can correct me, there's no funding presently for the eight priorities for health care service from the VA right now.
Category 8s have they've stopped enrollment in Category 8.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thanks for your hard work on this. Next up, let's bring up Mr. Fred Schaefer, Mr. Forrest Baller, and Mr. William McLaughlin.
Take that that way. I got a question for
Good afternoon and welcome.
Good afternoon. My name is Fred Schaefer, and I am the Oregon State Commander of the National Association of Atomic Veterans. And we're requesting July 16th as a special day in the state of Oregon. Every year we go before the governor. The governor gives us a proclamation that states, we've got it. but we would like to have it more official from the state. Oregon would be the fourth state in the 50 states to grant this. The reason why no more have, because we've just started this program going in the last 5 years, I guess, is where it really started. So we would love to have this, and we, if it wasn't for the internet, the atomic veterans wouldn't be where we're at right now. Nobody knew, everything was top secret. Wives tell stories that even their husbands couldn't tell their wives that they participated in. And we were test site participants, and they say it's not right now. Their statement states that it was not service connected, but we were there. They didn't ask us if we wanted to become a test site participant, and to see a giant X-ray go off. And you hold up your hand and you see the bones in your hands with glasses that are so dark you can't see night and day. So it's, and several people were within 1,500 yards of it. They said our ship was approximately a mile away when it went off. And the fish are jumping out of the water to beat this tidal wave that's coming at your ship. So you know something is there. So we'd like to have just a little bit of recognition in the state. And we've had a good job. We loved it. It was our service. We wanted to do it, and now we find out we're a very select few, and things are changing for us now. I'll answer any questions that I can.
Thank you. Sir?
Thank you, and good afternoon. My name is Forrest Baylor. I'm past Department Commander, Disabled American Veterans. I'm an atomic veteran in Operation Hardtack in 1958. I'm one of the ones that he's speaking about that I've seen the bones in my hand like an X-ray with the meat in my hand just a very pale, pale pink. Now, when we did not have glasses, they would just go this way with our hands. The shock wave from these atomic bombs was atrocious. On board ship, it was so severe that it shattered the communication wires, the, what do you call them, the glass that's on the end of each one of the it shattered them, and the horizontal communication wire came down, vertical horizontal communication wire came down and coiled up like a snake. Out of communication, none whatsoever. Okay, now we started back in 1945. The first test subject, I mean, test was in Nevada, if I'm correct.
In Mexico.
Mexico, you're correct, excuse me. And so therefore, it went from there to two big ones that ended the war on Japan. And from there, it went on with the testing of more and more atomic bombs. And so they used animals, in which I have film of, where they used pigs that would run around an L-shaped trench, where they used goats, where they used rabbits strapped down. And then I showed a scientist coming out looking at his eyes. He was dead. I was talking to a friend of mine that pulled this pig out from underneath and said he was cut clear through 3 inches and dead. So that's just only but just a very simple part of it. Let's get back to the men on board ship who suffered the shockwave from these atomic bombs. It ripped through you. And it's something that you'll never, never, ever forget. Now, back in atomic veterans in World War II, the prisoners of war from Japan, in Japan, were subject to radiation exposure from the atomic bombs. And it goes on up from there, year after year, 1946 and on the way, all the way on up to 1958 to 62 to 63, atomic atomic bombs were used in Alaska, drilled way down into the holes. And so it has taken many lives of veterans who have died of cancer. I lost a friend, Joe Lyons, who lives in Dallas. He had a kidney operation done by out away from the VA. Went through him in less than a year. He had died. He was in operation heart attack also. And so there's many, many of them that have died of cancer, leukemia, if you will, lymphoma, if you will. I myself suffered cancer myself. I'm a survivor of cancer, secondary to radiation exposure. And for the most part, I know what I'm talking about. And this bill that we are asking for, I don't think it's too much. It took a long time for the government to recognize what they have done, not only to the veterans, if you will please, but to our children and grandchildren. This is a known fact. Now, my children themselves, I had two sons before I left. When I come back, we had three beautiful daughters. When they reached puberty around that age, one of them had a hole in her heart. Now, this does happen on occasion. The second one, about the same age, 11, 12, 13, somewhere in there, came down with a heart condition. Bad valves in her heart. My third daughter had a lot of trouble with her in school. She couldn't learn. And she was taken to Portland to see a doctor up there. And she is retarded. Now, it seemed rather strange that we have two sons that are healthy, that grew up to be boxing champions, Pacific Northwest boxing champions, and three daughters that are suffering today. We seek just simply justice. And this passing of this bill would enable for us to have one more step toward justice of this atomic veterans. I believe I have that all. If anybody would like to ask me any questions, I'm free to answer any that you would like to hear.
Thank you. Let's go to Mr. Is it McLagan?
McLagan.
Okay.
Did I forget to thank you?
No, you didn't. Have a seat. We'll ask you. Wait, no. Don't get anywhere. We're not going to let you off the hook so easy, sir. We're not going to let you off the hook so easy.
I thought you were still.
We're going to have two questions all at once.
He remembers. Run, Forrest, run. Madam Chairman and Senators, I thank you for the privilege of being able to come before you. I didn't know I was going to be called on. I guess I'm the rookie here. I just found out about NAAV, National Association of Atomic Veterans, and am in the process of joining. I also served at 7.3 Boat Pool Operation Heart Attack in 1958. I have a history of cancer-related illnesses, although I'm not asking for any specific consideration other than to just be recognized as an atomic vet. Last Veterans Day, I attended my son-in-law's church in Beaverton, and they asked the veterans to stand up and be recognized, which I did, and I received an applause along with my other fellow veterans. But I can't get that same recognition from the state of Oregon. And I'm here today just to simply ask for that. Ask that July 16th be recognized, that atomic veterans, those of us that are still alive, are alive and real veterans that had the great opportunity to serve this country. And I thank you for your kind attention.
Thank you. Questions? None? Well, I guess you are going to get Senator Farioli.
Madam Chair, I just want to recognize the Cold War veterans really were in a period of time when we were probably expending more money and doing more on a global scale to try to buy peace or to vouchsafe peace for the future generations than in many of the shooting wars that we'd been in. We expended an awful lot of national product. We developed technologies that were had never been tried before. In retrospect, a lot of them look to have been very risky. And we asked a lot of folks to take the risks without really explaining the risk. It wasn't a matter of choice. That, unfortunately, has been the history that we've had with all of our involvement with nuclear issues, nuclear energy, nuclear waste, nuclear weaponry. And we're going to be paying for that technology for hundreds of thousands of years. The half-life on the materials is many hundreds of thousands of years. And our knowledge about the effects of radiation on people was rudimentary at best in the 40s and 50s. And as we've learned more, the thresholds have dropped consistently. The exposure levels that cause harm are much lower than we previously imagined. And that's, I think, what led people to be in trenches with no protective gear. But the sacrifices that these gentlemen and women have made in being subjected to those tests, I think, were beyond extraordinary. It's something that we would not ask people to do in good conscience today. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's appropriate that we do something, some sort of recognition. I want to just thank these gentlemen for bringing the issue to people's consciousness. I think because the Cold War was so secretive and so long, mm-hmm. and the stakes were so high, mm-hmm. and the ultimate end of that was the detente and the significant reduction of global tensions that happened during the Reagan administration, that we owe maybe an unpayable debt of gratitude to these veterans. So I'm glad that they're here today. Sure.
Okay.
Can I say something?
Of course.
This, if you will, please.
Sure.
This wasn't asked of veterans. We were ordered to do that.
That I understand.
We were ordered to do that, and we were ordered to keep quiet for 20 years and not say anything after that.
Yeah, actually, that was the question, Madam Chairman. My understanding from other veterans is that you were, when you left the service, when you were separated, you were required to sign a confidentiality agreement, and you were not allowed to talk about these issues to your physicians or your family members. So I think that needs to be
not
part of
our wives.
Yeah.
Or
could you talk about that a little bit for the record,
Mr. Schaefer?
What I know of, I was in the 62 tests. We were there for 21 blasts at Christmas Island and Johnston Island for the big atmospheric test. When we left, there was not quite the secrecy. The first bomb went off. We were on our way to Christmas Island, and it was on the front page of the San Francisco Times. They took all our cameras away from us, so we couldn't take any pictures. And so we never had this 40-year moratorium put on us, which President Reagan removed when he was in office. And that's when it became very not classified. I've got stories of veterans that have got federal charges against them because they talked. You know, and this should not be, you know. They've never had anything done to them, but they've got charges against them that they could. And it was very top secret at that time, the first of it. So when I was there, there wasn't much secret. I mean, everybody knew it. We were a floating service station keeping our ships down there patrolling the outer limit, and you could see the Russian oiler that was down there with her tin cans and destroyers, and she was anchored in the bottomless ocean. But we couldn't find the bottom with ours. But she was anchored. It was fun.
And another thing I might add, it's just food for thought. From back when they were using these animals and killing them, testing them, whatever they had to do to them, that was cruel and inhuman treatment. So that they decided to go ahead and use military personnel for their test subjects. I have no further to say, and I thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yes. Madam Chair. There we go.
I was just going to mention, my dad was in the Air Force in New Mexico and witnessed the first atomic blast. It was because he was stationed at Deming Field. And at the time, they just told him it was a fuel depot that had exploded, you know, and they didn't tell him, you know, obviously it wasn't public. But I kind of want to follow up on what Senator Farioli said. You know, this, the military is something that is so invaluable to our country, and I serve in the military, but the veterans have been exposed to a lot of hazardous materials, whether it's Agent Orange in Vietnam, where the effects weren't disclosed, and even as recently as requiring the anthrax injections that have never been FDA approved, and yet they required that, and there was good evidence that there were serious health problems from those anthrax injections, and it's something that most servicemen just say, well, that's what we signed up for. But I think it is incumbent upon our country to recognize the debt that we owe and to take care of the people that have been injured. So I appreciate your coming here.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your service.
Any further questions?
I think you're off the hook.
Okay.
At least from us.
Thank you.
There's probably some press in the room, so they might get a hold of you.
Ron.
I think each number one is your attendance. I just needed someone to talk to today.
Anytime you want to come talk to us, Mr. Baylor, you can.
Okay, thank you.
Is it Robert Fluff? E Fluff? It looks like I F U F. Okay, how about Mr. Jim Jones? Come on up, Mr. Jones. So is it, I don't want to publish the phone number over the record system, but I would hate to miss. Is anybody named Robert in the room? Isn't that Robert? All right, Mr. Jones. Welcome.
Madam Chair, my name is, for the record, Jim Jones. A little bit of background. What Senator Ringo said, I got the double whammy. In 1958, I was with the... on a submarine. We were submerged at 400 feet, a half a mile from the blast and hardtack. We were down with Forrest's ship. In fact, his ship was our station ship that we tied up to. In Vietnam, we got the Agent Orange, and it run off of us like water. So we got all of it. We're not asking for any monetary things it would cost for this July the 16th. All we want is recognition for the forgotten ones that were used as guinea pigs for these bomb tests. And that's what I would like to have. Just a day of recognition and no money as far as that goes. And any questions I can go with?
Thank you, Mr. Jones. Questions for Mr. Jones? Just so you know, what we were talking about, Senator Farioli and I, is that he wanted to know what year I was born in, because what year I was born in, which I'm not going to tell you, and I'm not going to ask you to tell me what year you were born in, but... Senator Farioli is, no offense to Senator Farioli, the more, in terms of years, the more senior member of the committee here right now, because Senator Shields is gone. So, see, I'm like qualifying this a lot. So,
well, Madam Chair, I was just observing that when you were making your sacrifice on the front lines of freedom for us, we were children. I was 7 years old in 1958, and they were teaching us in our schools to duck and cover under our desks. So we all have memories of the Cold War and the issues that were happening. But it just seems to me that now that we are in our roles as your representatives here, it's incumbent on us to take the responsibility to do the duty that you did when we were children.
Well, you know how thick the hull of a submarine is. It's very thick for the depth. And I was on a World War II submarine, which... is nowhere near what they have today. We returned broadside to the blast.
Mm-hmm.
When the blast went off, they told us, don't hold on to anything because the shock will get you. While they counted down to zero, nothing happened. One of the helmsmen grabbed the wheel for the bow planes, and just as he grabbed the wheel, the shock hit. It moved the hull of the submarine in 6 inches, just collapsed it. It took the bones, this arm, all the way back, both arms. And his wrist was up to his elbows. It knocked him into the diving officer, which was standing close to the gyro table, cut him open like a knife, just across here, knocked him into the auxiliaryman and pinned him like a fly on the valves for the ballast tanks. Mm-hmm. And the damage externally to that submarine was awesome. We lost all sonar equipment, all hull platforms. Periscopes were bent over. We lost sail, which is the coming up out of the where the periscopes on the submarine are. We lost that. We lost a buoy, a life-saving buoy, and we were still sitting at 400 feet. And it took us 3.5 weeks after we pulled alongside Forrest's ship down there to get in condition where that we could get back to Pearl Harbor. And it took nearly a month then because we had engines knocked off the blocks and generators out of commission. So this was nothing that no one really expected. But the 3 weeks sitting alongside that ship, and all they had, they give us badges about every 4 or 5 hours. And they never told us what. And they told us if we said anything about where we was at, what we was doing, when we got back, we were immediately going to jail. Mm. No ifs, ands, or buts. And it was that way for until 1982 when they sent me a notice saying that, it's been recognized you were in Operation Hardtack. Journey on. We're not going to tell you what any of the results were. And since then, I found out a lot of people have died from radiation. And but all we want is just recognition.
The little plastic bags were Rankin meters that
right.
Measure accumulated dose of radiation.
Right.
They didn't work.
Yeah. Did they turn colors? And
they took ours away 2 days after we got them because they told us they were malfunctioning. Film turns red when it's over its coast. They took
our bedding away from us, and they came in with all new blankets and everything before we left. They changed all of our blankets and bedding, everything. I had navy gray wool blankets when I went down there. Well, I don't know how in the world they did it without nobody knowing. At least I didn't know. And so anyways, they went down, and I had some white wool navy blankets. And I didn't know how in the world they ever got there. Nicely made up, but you couldn't bounce the floor off of it.
Any further discussion? Mr. Baylor, I might suggest you and your friends might take on, if you have another project you're interested in lobbying in, I think you all could have another career in lobbying at the Oregon legislature if you're... Did you want to come up, sir?
Thank you very much, ma'am.
I don't mind.
I've been on four of those things down there, and we had two spooks on the first land base out of Desert Rock, Nevada. I've been on four of them. Now, that person was a real adventure. And after the first shot went off, we were looking to see what happened. One of them had a long white coat, and he was a civilian guy. The other one was wearing lead deals. He was a good guy. I had one of those things over on this side, and I had one over on this side. And it was just still settling down the rocks and gravel and whatnot. One came over, grabbed one on this side, and one came over, grabbed one on this side. And then you see it for the next three. They came along, pulled me out of there, and the first flight sent me someplace called Korea.
Sir, did you want to come up?
I'm John Gabrielson, Mr. Chairman, gentlemen. I was in the 1955 teapot in Yucca Flats, Nevada, 505th Military Police Battalion for the 6th Army Headquarters. I was in a slit trench 1,500 feet from ground zero on a blast. We patrolled the perimeter. It was our orders that anyone who left that area were to be immediately arrested and taken to the headquarters at the Presidio San Francisco. And I went after prisoners to bring them back, and a squad of men would go after prisoners who would, I called them prisoners. They spoke about what they witnessed, and it was my responsibility to arrest these people and take them to the barracks at the Presidio San Francisco. Whatever happened to them, I have no idea. So, thank you.
Thank you. All right. Let's close the public hearing. If you all are ready, we're going to open a work session and move these bills to the Senate floor. Let's do the House bills first. Any amendments on the House bills?
None that we have, Madam Chair.
All right. The Chair would move House Bill 2136 to the Senate floor with a do-pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing seeing none. So ordered. Chair would move House Bill 2681 to the Senate floor with a do-pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. The Chair would move House Bill 2862 to the Senate floor with a do-pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Chair would move House Bill 2878 to the Senate floor with a do-pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing seeing none, so ordered. Senator Farriola, you want to carry House Bill 2136?
Okay.
I'll carry 2681. Ringo, do you want to carry 2862?
Sure.
And Atkinson, 2878? Thank you. All right, let's go into work session on the resolutions and memorials. Chair would open a work session on HCR 9, which designates July 16th of every year as Atomic Veterans Day. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing seeing none. So ordered. The Chair would move HJM 13. I'll go through them all and then do carriers. That's okay. HJM 13, which urges President and Congress to exempt veterans' pension income from federal income taxation, to the Senate floor with a do-adopt recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Chair would move HJM 15 to the Senate floor with a do-adopt recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing and seeing none. So ordered. Did I do HJM 15?
Yes.
Okay. Chair would move HJM 16 to the Senate floor with a do-adopt recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing seeing none. So ordered. Chair would move HJM 18 to the Senate floor with a do-adopt recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing seeing none, so ordered. Chair would move HJM 25A to the Senate floor with a do-pass, a do-adopt recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. And the Chair would move SJM 8 to the Senate floor with a do-adopt recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Okay, let's go back up to the top of the... Senator Farioli, would you do HCR 9?
Yes, ma'am.
Brown will do HJM 13. Ringo will do HJM 15. Atkinson, 16. Shields, 18. Farioli, HJM 25. And Brown, SJM 8. For all the veterans in the room, thank you very much for your service to the country. I hope these few bills and memorials will do feel like a little bit of justice. And we'll certainly be look forward to working with you at the federal level to see what we can do to move Congress forward.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Committee be in recess till, let's get till 5 after 2. Back on the record, for the committee as information, and I just went over this with the vice chair, I would like to clarify that the intent of the Senate rule Committee on Rules and filing of clarify the rules and the filing and the final days of this session. The rules currently state that when the Senate is under 1 hour notice, minority reports shall be submitted as soon as practicable. The chair interprets this to mean that the minority draft amendments must be requested from legislative counsel within an hour following the committee meeting where notice was given. And in order for our staff to complete their work in an orderly and practical manner, it's expected that the minority report be submitted to committee staff within an hour after receipt from legislative counsel. The time frame that legislative counsel takes to draft the minority reports will be dealt with. So I'll get this to you in writing, but that's everyone's on notice from here on out that that's the scoop. All right, we're in work session on Senate Bill 1000. Ms. Harris.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Committee. Last time we had Senate Bill 1000 before us was June 23rd, and on the 23rd, we had a work session. We adopted a Dash 2 amendment and a conceptual amendment with Mr. Hendricks from LC in the room. We never expressly adopted the Dash 3 amendment, which is a combination of the conceptual amendment and the Dash 2 amendment. So we have the Dash 3 before us.
Okay.
We also have a Dash 6 and a Dash 7 amendment. And just to clarify for the record, the Dash 6 amendment that we have before us modifies or tracks the Dash 3s. The Dash 7 is not in conflict with the Dash 3 amendment. It tracks the original bill. So should the committee choose to adopt any or all of those amendments, legislative counsel will essentially blend those amendments together. And so, again, if the committee were to adopt all of those amendments, the bill that would be dropped at the Secretary of the Senate's desk would be dropped with a Dash 8 amendment that will blend all of the things that we adopt today should the committee adopt those amendments before us.
Okay. Any questions on that for Ms. Harris? All right. Mr. McKean, why don't you come forward, please, and walk us through the Dash 6s and the Dash 7s. Senator Wesselin, I don't know if you want to join him at the dais or you're fine where you're at. It's up to you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Doug McKean from Legislative Council. The Dash 6 amendments would amend the...
I'm sorry, Mr. McKean, can you move the mic closer? You have a very soft voice.
That's true.
Which just makes Legislative Council a good place for you to be, right?
Very true. I wasn't designed to be a trial attorney. The Dash 6 amendments... deal with the exemption for religious institutions from certain provisions of the Civil Rights Law. currently in ORS 659A.006 in subsection 2. There's an exemption that allows bona fide churches and religious institutions an exemption so that they can hire members of their own faiths. We've moved that language in the dash 6 amendments, moved that language out of 659A.006, which is in section 3 of the bill on page 2, and moved it into the section of ORS chapter 659A, which is section 030, and that's on page 3 of the bill, section 5. And that's the section of current law that deals with employment discrimination. So it made sense to move that provision that provides this exception for employment discrimination to that section. So if you look at the first page of the dash 6 amendments, it creates a new subsection 6 to 659A.030, and it would put that in. If you look at the bill on page 4, at line or underline 42, it would add a new subsection 6 and 7. The new subsection 6 is nearly word for word the language that's currently in 659A.006, moving that same exemption for religious institutions to the 659A.030. The language in the new subsection 7, which again is on page 1 of the amendment, dash 6 amendment, is brand new language. And what it does is it says it's not an unlawful employment practice for a bona fide church or sectarian religious institution to discriminate on the basis, based on sexual orientation, and then it gives three paragraphs. Let me just stop there for a second. That language, the bona fide church or sectarian religious institution, is identical to the language that's already in the law talking about that religious exemption. So there's nothing new there.
And Mr. McKean, just generally speaking, not an in-depth definition, but could you talk about what a bona fide church or sectarian religious institution, what the law generally says, what those are?
Those are not defined terms.
Okay.
And there are no court cases describing what those terms mean. The current law, if you look in 659A.006, when it talks about a sectarian religious institution, it gives examples, says, including but not limited to a school, hospital, or church camp. So it gives some sense of what a sectarian religious institution means in the current law.
Okay.
That's about as much as I can give you.
Okay, that's fine.
The three paragraphs of subsection 7.
Right. And just to clarify for the record, that is current statutory law at this point in time. Okay.
That's correct.
Thank you.
So paragraph A of subsection 7 says that it's not an unlawful employment practice for the church or institution to discriminate on the basis of sexual orientation in employment positions in the church or institution, such as clergy, religious instructors, and staff support. So that paragraph is designed to get at employment right at the church or the religious institution. Paragraph B talks about employment positions in a religious school, religious camp, religious daycare center, religious thrift store, religious bookstore, religious radio station, or religious shelter. Again, those would be positions right in those sorts of religious facilities or institutions. Paragraph C talks about in other employment positions that involve religious activities, as long as the employment position is not connected with a commercial or business activity that has no necessary relationship to the church or institution. The last phrase of that, the commercial or business activity that has no necessary relationship to the church or institution, again, parrots existing law, and that's what's in current 659A.006.
Thank you.
The one difference there, though, if you look at 659A.006, at the end of that phrase, it says, has no necessary relationship to the church or institution or to its primary purpose. That language, or to its primary purpose, does not appear here.
Thank you. Senator Westlin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I genuinely can't tell you how happy I am to be here to today to testify on behalf of Senate Bill 1000, but most of all, and most importantly, on behalf of the substantive improvements that have been made to this landmark civil rights legislation. In particular, these amendments come from the hours upon hours, the hundreds upon hundreds of witnesses that have testified on these issues. In particular, the Dash 7s clarify what was always understood by the sponsors of Senate Bill 1000, but more importantly by same-gender couples, and that is that marriage and civil unions are not the same. Thus, the Dash 7s delete the word same and insert substantially equivalent throughout the bill. The Dash 6 address what was an equally heartfelt expression throughout these hours and hours of testimony expressed by some churches and sectarian institutions, and that is, I believe, we have taken the issue of the court's defining core mission out of these discussions. We have included a list of specific issues that, as we went back and looked at the testimony of specific items or entities, if you will, that could have been impacted, specifically religious schools, religious camps, religious daycare centers, religious thrift stores, religious bookstores, religious radio stations, and or religious shelters. We have proactively put those into the bill, and then, as Doug has indicated, in paragraph sub C, line 23, we have included a catch-all phrase that would allow the exemption of any other such enterprises, or perhaps that's a wrong word, religious entities other than commercial enterprises to be included should we have forgotten or overlooked something, or something that was not spoken to in the previous testimony on from the witness stand by the many witnesses that testified on these, not only this bill, but Senate Bill 1073. Madam Chair, in many regards, what these amendments reflect is very much what this legislature is all about. It's something I've long held to be true, and that is that the committee process is really the best thing the Oregon citizens have going for them. We look at these issues over, under, sideways, down. We contemplate, we reflect, and we make decisions based on that testimony. I think these two amendments substantially improve this bill, and it's a reflection of not only the commitment of the Oregon citizens, but the will of this legislature, and in particular this committee, to make this bill as good as it possibly can be. I think we have succeeded. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Westland. A couple of questions for you. Is it your understanding that the Dash 7s clarify that Senate Bill 1000 is not the same as marriage?
Absolutely. I never felt that. But
okay. And it is it your understanding that civil unions will not be recognized by federal law?
They are prohibited from being recognized by federal law, Madam Chair.
And Senator Westland will not be transferable to other states?
Regrettably, they will not be allowed to be transferable to other states.
Unless those states recognize civil unions.
Unless those states recognize civil unions.
And do not allow same-sex couples to marry. Is that correct?
Federal law prohibits that. The state of Oregon prohibits that. This bill does not allow same-sex couples to marry.
And who participated in the drafting of the Dash 6 amendments, Senator Westland?
A group of legislators, certainly legislative council, the ACLU, representative staff from Representative Bates, Westland, and Morris's office, as well as your office, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And is it your intent that the Dash 6 provide to religious institutions and organizations in this state the maximum flexibility in hiring practices in regards to the issue of sexual orientation under our state constitution?
Absolutely, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Thank you. Senator Farrelly.
In that working group, who were the representatives of the religious organizations that helped craft the exemption for churches?
The representation of the religious groups, I would have to say that I was carrying much of that information and expression of will and intent.
I think that, Madam Chairman, must be a no, that there were no religious representatives from the bona fide religious institutions.
Actually, Senator Farrelly, that is incorrect. Okay. I believe Senator
Morris
is a bona fide person representing his religion.
Theologian.
Madam Chair, I think there's a difference between the...
He's a doctor in theology, Senator Farrelly.
No, and more power to him, Madam Chair. That's not the question or the thrust of the question. We've had testimony from the Catholic Church and from other churches. I just wondered which of those folks that have been very interested in this bill were consulted in writing the definition, the expansive definition of exemption for the churches. Were any of them involved from the bona fide religions that would claim and be deputized by those bona fide religions to be representative?
I would genuinely say, Senator Farrelly, that the reason for this meeting, indeed meetings being called, was to address their concerns. It was a very sincere effort, and I believe we have succeeded very well in addressing the issues expressed before these committees.
Madam Chair, I hope you'll allow opportunity for views from those that represent those churches to disagree.
No, I won't, Senator Farrelly. We're in work session.
And Madam Chairman, I think it's very disingenuous to represent to people that their religions were in the negotiation of this process when clearly they were not.
Senator Farrelly, this was not a negotiation. This was a meeting of the sponsors of the bill to address the concerns raised by Mr. Castagna and Ms. Smith. No other religious organization raised any concerns. I had Mr. Castagna's language in the room. It was talked about. I don't know how long I was not there for the entire meeting. So, no, I'm not intending to bring up Mr. Castagna from the Catholic Church because we frankly don't have time to bring up all of the religious organizations and institutions in the state.
Okay, Madam Chair, I accept your wisdom. I do have some other questions if you don't mind.
Fire away.
Since we've started on the question of the exemption clause, was there an attempt to broaden the exemption clause for churches from the previous version? I guess I would be asking legal counsel.
The version you had before you before was in the dash 2, and in that one, I would say this version is a little different. The dash 2 version also referred to bona fide churches and sectarian religious institutions. It also borrowed language from the existing law. It did have that phrase at the end about has no necessary relationship to the church or institution or its primary purpose. So there was an alternative in that version that you will not see in this version, in the dash 6 version.
So was the effect to broaden the exemption for churches or to narrow it?
Manager. Senator Westland, why don't you respond?
Yeah, the very specific purpose of this meeting was to broaden it to meet some of the concerns of churches and religious institutions in two areas. One was the level, I guess that would be the right word, of employee that was exempted. The first version indicates that it was only those employees associated with the core mission of the institution. These amendments provide for all levels of employee, from the example we've been using, janitor, up to the priest or clerical institution. So this very definitely broadens it. The other specific attempt that I believe was achieved is to keep any discussion or keep the issue of what a church or religious institution's core mission is out of the church, or I mean out of the courts. And I believe we have achieved that in the dash sixes as well. Both of those issues were very definitely discussed. And in addition to that, things that we started a list. As remiss as we were to do that, there was just enough testimony from prior witnesses expressing concerns, I think with some... I know with heartfelt passion and some legitimacy with regard to things like religious bookstores and religious radio stations. I think this is a significant broadening of this exemption.
Thank you. Senator Westland, and to reiterate that on lines 21 through 22, what is now present is essentially a laundry list of what I would call religious employment positions in religious institutions that were not specifically designated in the prior version, and frankly were subject to legal interpretation in the prior version. This is an explicit listing of institutions. Isn't that correct?
That is correct, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator Farrell.
Madam Chair, in line 16 we've got the word bona fide church without legal definition. We don't know what a bona fide church is, so I assume the first burden of proof to people would be to claim the exemption was to prove that they have a bona fide church.
There is a body of case law that defines bona fide church. That's not
a new... Actually, I would prefer that the attorney answer, Senator.
Well, but I'm sure you could understand it better if I said it. I have a lower education level.
Love the theatrics. Really
that
want to get
good.
To the meat of the
issue.
I have not done that research. I don't know if there's a body or a line of cases that describe what that phrase means in Oregon law.
Thank you. I think that would indicate that some additional scholarship is necessary before bona fide has any meaning to people, at least at the discussion point.
Mr. McKean, let me finish. Senator Farrelly, Senator Westland. Mr. McKean, that is currently an Oregon statute, is it not?
That is.
And do you know how long it's been an Oregon statute? Several decades? We're getting indications from the audience. Would about 1969 be...
Roughly correct.
Thank you. Senator Westland, did you want to comment on that as well?
Well, and I would not want Mr. McKean and or I to leave this dais without thinking that there is not a body of law that has been determined defining a bona fide church. Many individuals have claimed that they are a church. Several of our prisoners in the Department of Corrections, these cases have come to trial, and it has created a definition of bona fide church.
Madam Chair,
Senator Farrelly,
the other issue that we are still on the question, I believe, of a church exemption, and the testimony is that the amendment that's proposed broadens the exemption. And in line 23 and 24, we also see in the broadened exemption and other employment positions that involve religious activities. Is there a definition in statute of what are religious activities? And I'll offer as an example. Many bona fide, if I may do violence to the term, because I don't know what it means, religions feature as a practice the use of incense. And that, the burning of incense can be a religious practice or a religious activity. But you can buy incense at practically any retail store, and the burning of that incense is not. How does one make the difference between, how does one define what a religious activity is? Is that wholly within the mind of the practitioner or the person involved in the activity? Or is it some preset doctrine that I could find in the records of the bona fide church? I mean, how did you define in your mind positions, if they do involve religious activities, what the religious activities were? Could raking the leaves be considered a religious activity?
All right.
I'm going to let the two of you think about that for a minute. I'm going to close temporarily the work session on Senate Bill 1000, open a public hearing and possible work session for Senator Shields to vote on the prior House bills. Senator Shields would like to vote on the...
Without objection, is that?
I haven't finished yet, Senator Farrielly. House Bill 2136, 2681, 2862, 2878, HCR 9, HJM 13, HJM 15, HJM 16, HJM 18, HJM 25, SJM 8. Senator Shields was out of the hearing attending a Natural Resources Ways and Means Subcommittee. Is there any discussion, any objection to Senator Shields voting on these bills? It would not change the outcome. Thank you very much. So ordered. Senator Shields, how do you vote?
Aye on all the above.
All right. Senator Shields, be recorded on all of the prior bills, which unless you need me to read, Linda, again, I will not read. Thank you very much. You're a good human being. Okay.
I think he's actually carrying some of those.
Yes, he is. Let's go back to a work session on Senate Bill 1000.
So,
Senator Varioli's question was basically, since we've never seen these words before, how do we know what they mean?
Madam Chair, Doug McKean, Legislative Council again. The new language in line 23, other employment positions that involve religious activities is not defined in the bill.
Okay.
But that phrase that involve religious activities modifies the employment position, so it's a position that involves religious activities.
Got it.
So it would occur to me that it would be the employer that would determine what those religious activities are rather than the employee determining that this particular activity happens to be a religious one.
Okay.
And for the record, I would like to reiterate that the focus of the amendment is not about second-guessing the employment decisions of religious institutions. It's about regulating the 99% of businesses that are engaged in commerce, that are employing Oregonians in their business operations, like our other currently existing employment non-discrimination statutes.
I'm sure I understand that.
Thank you, Senator.
Where I'm going with this line of questioning is in broadening the boundary for the exemption, there was a clear recognition that the boundary had been drawn too narrowly. In broadening this exemption,
Senator Farrielly, just for the record, that was not my intent that it was too narrow. It was to address the concerns raised by Mr. Castagna.
Madam Chair, I have no reason to argue that point. For whatever reason, we decided to broaden the exemption. We still left an edge, and that's addressed in C, because we're talking about in other employment positions. So we've got A, which has a list of church institution, clergy, religious instructors, and support staff. B, which talks about schools, religious camps, religious daycare centers, religious thrift stores, bookstores, radio stations, religious shelters, and in C, other. So we have a boundary. We have a boundary beyond which there is a question of whether or not the exemption is sufficient at law to protect the religious institution. Who would make the decision about that sufficiency?
Madam Chair, Senator Farrielly, the Bureau of Labor is one of the enforcement, or is the enforcement agency for this, so they might be involved in that because they have rulemaking authority. And then, of course, people can litigate these things privately in the courts, and so courts might choose to, they might have to decide what constitutes an employment position that's not connected with a commercial or business activity.
Mr. McKean, in terms of religious activity, and you may not be aware of this, but the U.S. Supreme Court has set forth definitions and requiring certain connections between the institution and the activity. Isn't that not correct?
I'm sure the U.S. Supreme Court and the Oregon courts, I know the Oregon courts have talked about these issues in the context of the federal and state constitutional provisions dealing with free exercise of religion and establishment of religion. I'm not sure that anyone has in the context of this particular statute.
Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to clarify for the record that if the boundary exists, and I believe it does because we've talked about the specific exemptions and we've moved from the very specific to the general to the other category, that there is a boundary, and that even though we haven't defined religious activities and we don't have a clear definition of what bona fide religion is, that Dan Gardner will know that we will take these issues that draw the state in questions of ambiguity into the issue through the court system, that the first thing we'll have to do is exhaust administrative remedies, and that those administrative remedies having a connection to employment will end up in Dan Gardner's Bureau of Land, Bureau of Labor and Industries. And I appreciate that your observation of how this mechanism works is the same as my understanding. Madam Chair, I believe that the appropriate approach to this is not to try to narrow or widen a boundary on an exemption. It is simply not to drag the state into the issue of state-church relationships, definitions, practices, whether those are liturgical practices or employment practices or discrimination practices. And this amendment draws the state clearly into the questions of ambiguity.
But Senator Farioli, I believe we've already done that when we prohibited discrimination based on gender, race, ethnicity, marital status, and others. I believe the state has already made that step, and if you read Chapter 659, you will see that that has already been discussed.
Madam Chair, I think that the problem here is in the approach to solving the problem. I mean, the difficulty I'm having is that this approach causes a collision between church and state that will be resolved at the Bureau of Labor and Industries first. And I don't know that that was the intention of the drafters.
Madam
that
Chair,
would be the effect of the draft.
You know, I just think that's completely untrue. This does not bring the state into some conflict with the church. Ultimately, the courts have to interpret the language of the statute, and I think counsel has done everything possible to use plain language. Religious activities, those are both plain language. Yes, they are subject to interpretation. That's what courts do every day. Every day, courts interpret statutory language. Probably they're going to do it here, but it seems to me it's drafted in a reasonable fashion to apprise the public what's intended. Certainly we could, and we also do that all the time, pass legislation where we know there are gray areas. We know there are gray areas, but we choose not to clarify them in every minuscule way that we possibly could. We leave it open to interpretation. That's what we do. Section 7, sub C, is going to be interpreted probably by the court someday. That doesn't mean we're dragging the state into this debate in some improper way. So I think it's appropriate.
And Senator Farioli, for the record, it would at least this drafter's intent that the other in C was referring to the list in B and making sure that it was not an exclusive list but rather an inclusive list. So in case we left something out like we hadn't thought about, like a religious website or whatever, that as our technology changes and our business relationships change, that we provided an inclusive list as opposed to an exclusive list. So I just disagree with your analysis, your legal analysis, and the impact of this amendment.
Madam Chair, I am a layperson. I'm not an attorney. I asked a question of legal counsel. They're the ones that mentioned the Bureau of Labor and Industry. I agree with that. My thrust in this line of questioning is, again, I'll just iterate that and then I'll move on to the other question, is that an exclusion for religion ought to simply say that nothing in this law shall affect. And it doesn't do that. When you go to a list, you fail. You leave in a boundary. The boundary leaves ambiguity. The ambiguity leads to litigation. That was my thrust, Madam Chair. If I can move to another question.
Madam Chair.
Senator Shields.
Before the good senator moves to another question, I've been sitting here thinking, you know, I was an administrator in a church. I mean, every pastor is an administrator as well. I had anywhere from 2 to 10 employees, in various churches. And I keep looking at this and reading it and saying, I can work well within the parameters. I understand. I move staff around to meet needs. They might be raking leaves, as Senator Ferrioli said one minute. The next minute, they're doing something very central to the task of the church. Not to say that raking leaves isn't central if it gets the leaves off the sidewalk that a parishioner might slip and fall on the way into worship. You know. So I look at these and I say to myself, this is, for me, after 31 years as a pastor, this is pretty clear stuff. I understand that the senator is looking for ambiguity, but I see breadth and I see sideboards, and I'm just giving you my perspective as a clergy person.
Thank you, Senator Shields. Senator Ferrioli.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I believe that no person involved in this issue has any ulterior motive or has any has approached this with anything other than the attempt to create good legislation. The questions that I'm bringing are, I believe, they're substantive questions. Madam Chair, the question that next occurs to me is that the intent is to modify the bill to include substantially equivalent, and I'd like to have a definition of substantially equivalent, if I may.
Thank you. Mr. McKean.
Madam Chair, Senator Ferrioli, equivalent has a meaning of equal in value or volume, that kind of meaning. And substantially means, I had a definition, in the same degree, roughly the... can't think of a good example. I had language.
Here's the layman's term, close.
The rest of the phrase is footnotes to God. Madam Chairman, let me share the Merriam-Webster's dictionary thesaurus definition of equivalent. Same, equal, identical, equivalent, self-same, not different, not differing from. So that those are the published definitions of equivalent. The word substantially perhaps causes a little bit of in the mind of the apprehender of the word, a little notion perhaps that it's not, that it's a qualifier. And you could have used chiefly, basically, by and large, generally, largely, mainly, mostly, predominantly, primarily, or principally. But that also leads you to nearly, practically, virtually, approximately, and a whole host of other synonyms. But the term equivalent is the same, same as. The issue here is, it really leads to the central question, and I think that's the one that we have to deal with. The reason I believe that we're moving same as, or the same, and we're moving that out of the bill, and inserting substantially equivalent, is to get away from the potential for litigation under the constitutional question. Only I'm concerned that moving a phrase in, like substantially equivalent, doesn't get you there because of the problem with language equivalent. And everywhere in Oregon statute where the word marriage occurs, you would insert the new phrase, whatever you choose. And from a practical standpoint, if you modify every single statute in the Oregon Revised Statutes that refers to marriage with whatever phrase it is, they become the same. So using the word the same may be a problem, and that's what I was concerned about in our other hearing. And I caused some research to be done on that. The word the same isn't the problem. The creation of the practical equivalency to marriage in law is the constitutional violation. So I don't think the word matters, and I'd like to hear the council talk about that.
So, Mr. McKean, does Senate Bill 1000 provide to same-sex couples the exact same rights and responsibilities and benefits that a marriage provides?
Madam Chair, I don't think it does.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, how do they differ?
for
I
one
can actually, I can actually go. Is it portable to another state if the other state... is it portable to another state unless the other state specifically... Right now, can you take a civil union to any other state in the country except for Vermont and Massachusetts?
And maybe California.
Maybe California. No. And will same-sex couples be provided Medicaid benefits under federal law?
No, Madam Chair, and there's a whole host of federal benefits that Oregon partners in a civil union would not be eligible for.
Will same-sex couples be allowed to marry under this bill?
No.
Any further questions?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Please proceed.
Can Oregon state statute require a federal benefit?
Madam Chair, Senator Federioli, no, but there are any number of state laws, for example, in a lot of the tax laws, that piggyback on federal requirements. Since the federal law won't recognize the partners in a civil union, then necessarily the state law won't either.
And Senator Farrelly, just for your information, the California Supreme Court ruled on this very issue yesterday. And the case is actually very interesting because the language in the statute and California's Prop 22 are extremely similar, if not the same, as our prior version of Oregon Senate Bill 1000 and the language of ballot measure 36. And what the court focused on was not the language of the measure and the initiative, i.e. the legislative measure and the initiative, but on the actual benefits. And the court in California said clearly, because same-sex couples cannot marry, because they cannot receive federal benefits, including state employment benefits by employers in the state that are governed by ERISA, that it is not, frankly, the same. And so I would just really encourage you to read that case. I think it would be a wonderful tool for you to take a look at, because I think that does resolve a number of your concerns about the language that we're adopting today.
Madam Chair, I think it makes my point that it isn't really the language that's at issue here. I was assuming that as long as you left the word same in the measure, that you had a clear violation of Measure 36. On further consideration, it isn't the word the same that's the problem. It's the quality of the benefits conferred that could be the problem.
Correct.
And if those things are substantially equivalent, then at least you have, in my opinion, a very likely set of challenges revolving around whether it's 448 benefits that are conferred, whether or not benefits that are conferred in Oregon might be recognized by some other states or all other states, and whether or not the state of Oregon can confer benefits that are recognizable by the federal agencies.
Well,
so I guess my conclusion, Madam Chair, and I'll conclude my, rather than be argumentative, I'll just conclude that I believe that what is in front of us in the amendments is still an invitation to litigation, an invitation to a collision between religious institutions and litigation over the definition of bona fide and religious activities, two separate phrases, and a transferal of those administrative decisions from religious institutions to secular institutions, and most likely, in because of the nexus with employment, likely to the Bureau of Labor and Industries. And I just don't think that is what churches intend to live with. I don't think that's what we intend to do to define the relationship between church and state, which should be of grave concern to most people in the state of Oregon. We hear almost daily some issue of the separation of church and state. And I think that what we have here is, by the good offices of the people that have worked hard on this issue, an inadvertent nexus between church and state that will, I think, eventually cause significant litigation and constitutional questions.
Do you have any further questions, Senator Farrioli?
Madam Chair, I have no further questions.
Thank you. Just for the record, about a dozen states have passed ballot measures and initiatives that explicitly prohibit civil unions. Ballot Measure 36 does not. End of statement. If folks wanted to prohibit civil unions in the language of Ballot Measure 36, they could have explicitly stated so. If they had intended to preclude a legal equivalent of marriage in Ballot Measure 36, they should have said so. Ballot Measure 36 did not limit the authority of Oregon's municipalities to establish or maintain domestic partnership registrations. It did not repeal the state's conferral of same-sex health insurance benefits to the employees of the state of Oregon, the State Board of Higher Education, and Oregon cities and counties. And it did not eliminate the state mandated family medical leave for Oregon employees who took time off to care for same-sex partners. No mention was made in Ballot Measure 36 of the attempt to limit the rights and obligations of domestic partnerships, civil unions, or any other kind of same-sex relationship. Any other questions? We need our full committee here. Thank you.
Madam Chair, could I request a 3-minute recess?
Sure.
Thank you.
We're in recess for 3 minutes. Thank you very much. The chair would move the dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 1000, which would combine the dash 2 amendments that we adopted last time around with the conceptual amendment.
Did she make the motion and leave?
She made a motion, and we're considering the motion.
Yeah. Mm.
Is there any discussion?
I think we've had sufficient discussion.
I'll be in recess until Senator Shields arrives. Okay.
The motion on the table was to move the dash three amendments. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing seeing none, so ordered. The chair would move the dash six amendments to Senate Bill 1000. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing seeing none, so ordered. The chair would move the dash seven amendments to Senate Bill 1000. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing seeing none, so ordered. The chair would move the bill to the Senate floor as amended.
Yes.
Discussion.
Okay. I would like to commend the effort of the chair and the committee to try to come together with a bill. I have a problem with the fact that the bona fide religious organizations were not consulted on the religious exemption. I think that's a huge tactical error, and I think will lead them to feel that they were excluded from a process that they feel passionate about and have a legitimate role in helping to craft. And I think that's a problem. I don't believe the mere language change solves the issue of equivalency, and I think that is exactly what's at the heart of Measure 36. So I believe that this measure, in fact, ends up just creating uncertainty and litigation. I don't think anyone intended to have a result that we heard testified to today from legal counsel that ambiguities in the interpretation of this law, should it pass, put the church in a hearings officer, into a hearings official's hearing room at the Bureau of Labor and Industries. I just don't think that was the intent here. I certainly don't know the definition of a bona fide church. It was not testified to today. I don't know what the parameters around the terms religious activities involved. That was not testified to today. For those reasons, I'll be voting no.
Thank you, Senator Farrelly. Any further discussion? All right. Would you please call the roll?
No.
Aye.
Aye.
No.
Chair votes aye.
Madam Chair, may I cast a courtesy aye?
Sure, Senator Westland.
Please record that.
Senator Westland records a courtesy aye. He wants to make sure he's the proud papa.
And Madam Chair,
Senator Farrelly.
Before the gavel fell, I would just like to make the statement that it is not our intention to serve notice of a possible minority report out of respect for proponents of this legislation and the work of this committee. We need to move forward on this thing. As I expressed, I think there are fatal flaws in this legislation, but legislators are going to have to look at this to determine for themselves whether it is a meaningful action by the legislature or a pointless gesture. And unfortunately, I think the latter is probably the ultimate determination. But thank you for the hearing and the opportunity to put my comments on the record.
Thank you, Senator Farrelly. We appreciate your willingness to work with us on amending the bill. And any further business to come before the committee? We're adjourned.